Wow. Shall we start?
Yes. Are we on the air now? So I see.
Definitely are. Okay. So we started our discussion, and actually it is time to do it officially. Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Today, the Kyiv School of Economics continues its initiative Global Minds for Ukraine with an extraordinary event. I'm Ivan Gomza, head of the Department of Public Policy. Here is Volodymyr Fedorin, he's a founding editor of Forbes Ukraine, and he will co-moderate our talk. And we are both really delighted to host an outstanding guest, Dr. Anne Applebaum. Dr. Anne Applebaum is a renowned scholar who studied the history of communism in Central and Eastern Europe. And among others, she published a very fine article on the Leninist origins of the repressions of civil society. In addition, Dr. Applebaum is an accomplished author of several books, including Red Famine and my personal favorite, Twilight of Democracy. Besides, Dr. Applebaum rarely stays secluded in the ivory tower of academia, being a daring journalist. So I am not mistaken, she visited Kyiv to interview President Zelensky after the Russo-Ukrainian war had erupted. So hopefully it is not an overstretch to say that Anne Applebaum is a real friend of Ukraine. So thank you for being with us today, and I hope that we will have a really interesting discussion.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm sorry we couldn't do this in person. I did come to Kyiv last week, but for a variety of reasons, it had to be a short trip. I was traveling with my editor. He had to return early, and I had to travel with him because we had to write our article on the train. So we did interview the president. We then spent a day we went to the northern suburbs, to Irpin and Bucha, and then we had to go back. It was short, but I hope I can come back again. Next time we'll do this in person.
Hopefully, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with a critical question. You are, among others, a scholar of genocides. And actually, I would like to explain our friends, what are the indicators of genocides? In what respects is genocide different from atrocities and war crimes? And finally, and most crucially, are Putin's intentions and Russian actions in Ukraine genocidal from the scholarly point of view?
So the term genocide is a difficult one because there are two kinds of definitions. There are some legal definitions that are attached to UN treaties and UN conventions. And then there is, a more popular or kind of moral way of defining genocide. Most of you probably know this, but it seems significant to me that the person who invented the word genocide, it was a word that was composed of, of sort of Greek roots, was born in Ukraine. Raphael Lemkin was a lawyer born in the Lviv area, and he went to the university in Lviv. I mean, of course, it was then Poland, but it was part of the interwar Polish Republic. But one of the things he wrote about during his lifetime was his experience of living in a part of the world where, different nations have historically tried to wipe one another out. And so, the concept of genocide very much comes out of Ukrainian historical experience or Central European historical experience. And his definition, what he meant by genocide, was the attempt to eradicate another nation as a nation. And so in his mind, that included not just mass murder, but also attacks on culture, on churches, attacks on language, an attempt to eliminate people, to eliminate a nation and a culture completely. One of the things that has misled people, I think, over the years, or not misled, but has shaped our conversation about genocide, is that the first time that word was used legally was in the context of the Holocaust. And so since then, people have looked at other situations where, one nation has tried to wipe out another, and they've said, well, it's not quite the same as the Holocaust. But really, the definition, Lemkin's definition, is a little bit broader than that, and I think would certainly include, and at this point, even legally, I think this would include Russian intentions in Ukraine. So the language that the Russians are using, you know, that Ukraine is not a state, Ukrainians are not real people. Anybody who says they're Ukrainian is really a Nazi. We are allowed to kill Ukrainians because they're Nazis, you know, by definition, because of the, because they say they're Ukrainians. And then their behavior, which is, you know, the deliberate targeting of civilians, the deliberate murder, you know, they arrive in these, even in some towns and villages, with lists of people who are Ukrainian leaders and so on. The attempt to, you know, erase and eliminate any traces of Ukrainianness. I think this is genocidal behavior, yes. It may not mean that they're trying to kill every single Ukrainian, which was what Hitler tried to do the Jews. And so that is a, that's a nuance of difference. But certainly the intent, which is to eliminate Ukrainians as a nation, as a race, or whatever you want to call them, as a people, is there. It's now very firmly part of Russian culture and Russian popular culture and Russian television culture. It's been inculcated and spread deliberately. I actually just written something about this, and it's coming out next week. You know, the idea also that Ukraine is a fake state that has been somehow used by the West as a tool against Russia, that it's not a real place. I mean, all those ideas and images have been part of Russian propaganda now for 10 years, and quite fiercely. And so I think what we're seeing is the effect of that use of genocidal language. I mean, soldiers seem to be convinced by it. We hear on some of the phone calls they make back home that some, you know, their relatives and wives back in Russia are also convinced by it. And so, yes, in that context, we can talk about genocide.
Okay, thank you. And the idea occurs to me, there is a good text by Rebecca Stern where she introduces the notion of libricide, like the destruction of books, for instance, holy books or cultural books. And we actually see this part of violent action here in Ukraine as well. In Kherson, the Russian troops actually, they destroyed Ukrainian books. But so I concur, actually, this is a genocidal intention and some genocidal actions. But now let's make it even more complicated, because President Macron, among others, he continues to refer to Ukrainians and Russians like two brother nations, and thus he explains there could be no genocide. And I myself could not sincerely believe that a person, the president of France, who got his education at Sciences Po, that he could really be ignorant that Bosniaks and Serbs actually were kinsmen. And despite all this, there was Srebrenica. Instead, I suppose, the rhetoric of brethrens reveals that some Western politicians eschew acknowledging the fact of the genocide. So my question to you, what would it take for the West actually to acknowledge what we scholars are already acknowledging?
So in the case of Macron, I mean, I obviously have not discussed this with him, so, you know, I don't know, but in the case of Macron and some other politicians, there is, I'm hearing now the argument that, I mean, I'm just explaining what the argument is. The argument is that we should not talk about war crimes, and we should not talk about genocide when speaking to Putin, because we want to allow him some way out of the war. So there is a argument among some diplomats that this is not the time to use that language. Because we do want him to leave Ukraine and withdraw his troops, and therefore it's not useful right now to talk about him as a war criminal, because we may need to negotiate with him, we may need to get him to agree to some international agreements, and declaring him a criminal and setting up prosecutions at the international courts will impede that process. And while I might, and maybe you might, disagree with that analysis, I don't think it's a bad faith analysis. In other words, I don't think Macron is doing that, you know, because he's anti-Ukrainian or because he, you know, doesn't, you know, because he, you know, he doesn't see what's happening. My guess is that he does see what's happening. It's just that he, you know, believes that there's a different, you know, there's a solution to the war that might require some cooperation of Putin, and therefore it's better not to eliminate him right now.
It is somehow akin to a situation when there is a hostage crisis and you don't want actually to aggravate the feelings of the staker.
Something like that. Or it's not even about his feelings, it's just that we might need him to be involved in some kind of diplomatic conversation to end the war. And as I said, I don't think that's an illegitimate argument. It has a basis in reality. And the follow-up could be that, well, you know, later on we'll talk about these things and what happened when we're in a position to do something about it. It's also important to remember, and this I haven't myself decided what I feel about it, but you know, there's another argument that says calling Putin a war criminal and calling for him to be investigated now, when we don't have the power to do anything about it, there is no court that can make him come from Moscow to The Hague, you know, or from, you know, to some kind of Nuremberg trial. While we don't have the power to do it, it's a little bit impotent, and it's like play acting. It's a performance rather than a real investigation. And I accept that argument has some legitimacy too, you know, that it's better to wait until we have a real moment. What I do think is important, and as I could see even in Kiev, the brief time I was there that this is happening, is that Ukrainians begin to document what's happening as accurately as possible, so that there is a real historical record, including both, you know, basic facts, but also deep interviews with people, getting people's stories down, recording them, preserving them, and beginning to think about how to use them or how to present them to the world, in maybe in a variety of different ways, maybe in a legal form, as a, you know, eventually as a lawsuit, maybe in a in plays and movies. You know, there are a lot of different ways in which you'll eventually want to tell the story, and I think that should be the priority now, to do that. I mean, you know, a counter argument is that, you know, given that Putin has committed these criminal acts and that he has used this genocidal eliminationist language about Ukraine, you know, is there any real deal that can ever be done with him? I mean, is he somebody who's capable of creating an agreement with any countries? I mean, not just with Europe or with Ukraine. Is there a format in which we could ever rely on anything that he says? And that's I don't have an answer to that either. I think probably there's not. I know that the President Zelensky and people around him are thinking about what kind of, I mean, some people are beginning to think about how could this war eventually end. And one of the things they're thinking about is, could there be some system of security guarantee that would ensure that, you know, if Putin breaks rules that are set up after the war, that there would be automatic sanctions or some kind of automatic reaction, and we wouldn't need to have this months of debate. And so maybe there is some, you know, there's some alternative world system we could come up with that would have better and more timely ways to respond to this kind of crime. But right now we don't have it. So there is a danger of, as I say, first of all, doing something that would make some solution in the end difficult. Second of all, there's a danger of empty gestures, you know, saying we're going to prosecute you and then not being able to do it. I think on balance, I'm still in favor of using the word genocide and continuing to investigate this as a case of genocide. But I wouldn't eliminate all other views as evidence of lack of knowledge.
Well, thank you for such a elaboration on this issue. It was really,
maybe it's more nuanced than you wanted, but that's just,
no, actually,
that's what I'm thinking of.
I'm here to have a meaningful discussion, and you're actually doing a great job. The only problem is actually I'm thinking that, you know, we humanity, I mean, we have quite a poor record while persecuting the genocide. Those genocide in Rwanda, they actually remained free, and then there was the Great War of Congo of Africa, and the genocide in Indonesia, they actually remained free and actually quite rich. I mean, they have many assets. So our record here is poor. But okay,
yes.
You actually touch a question I also eager to discuss. It is about the repercussions. So how do you think what do you think would be the societal and political repercussions of the war? In particular, I'm interested in your opinion. So will the war consolidate or rather further dismantle the liberal consensus, liberal order? So is there any hope for liberalism now, or the golden age of liberalism is a turned page?
So, I mean, I think, you know, the war is an illustration of the fact that, you know, this so-called liberal world order is really only, it's only as good as the willingness of its members to defend it. You know, the fact is that the US and Europe are defending it now in their defense of Ukraine. But I also hope that one of the conclusions that people will come to when the war is over is that we need new and better institutions. That the, you know, the poor performance of the United Nations in this conflict, I mean, obviously because one of it, the member leading members of the Security Council is a, you know, is the aggressor in the war. But also this the fact that other institutions took so long to react. You know, this war has been discussed and predicted and debated for 8 years. I mean, I actually expected the invasion of Mariupol in the summer of 2014. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it took a long time to happen, you know, is really the surprising part. And the fact that despite the fact that it was so clear and it was the Russians have been preparing for it, and they've been preparing for it not only militarily, but also, as I've said, kind of, you know, ideologically and in terms of their propaganda, you know, and yet we were somehow surprised, and, you know, the US didn't have quite the right weapons in play, and, you know, we weren't quite ready for it when it happened. We didn't have, you know, it took, you know, instead of having automatic sanctions everywhere on the first day, you know, it took us a few weeks to kind of get them in place, and still they're not all in place. I mean, that, you know, that to me is an indication that people didn't take this threat seriously, and they didn't believe in it. They didn't, you know, they didn't understand it, and the institutions weren't really, you know, the early warning signs weren't sufficient. And so one of the things I hope is that coming out of this war, we'll have a, you know, better and more aware and more intelligent kind of early warning systems in place, and we'll have thought through better what our reaction will be next time. One of the problems with, you know, the sort of American West European attitude to autocracy, and especially its Russian and Belarusian autocracy in the last decade, has been that every time some kind of new horrible violation happens, we're surprised. So whether it's, you know, the Belarusians hijacking a plane, whether it's the Russians murdering somebody in the center of Berlin, you know, or in the center of London, you know, every time it happens, we, you know, we are shocked and surprised, and we, you know, how do we react? What do? And we draw up a list of sanctions, and we announce, you know, a lot of things. And, you know, rather than doing that, it's more important to, in the future, to be aware that these things will happen and to announce in advance what the price is or what the cost will be. For, you know, for this kind of thing. So thinking a little bit differently about how we do diplomacy, how we use sanctions, how we react to these kinds of violations, I hope that's one of the things we'll do coming out of the war.
Okay, thank you. You know, I have like a kind of a historical parallel in my mind. In the dark years of the Second World War, nobody actually believed that liberal ideas would come eventually in full glory. I mean, I think in 1942, nobody was sure that liberal ideas could have the stage in the world politics. And then after that turmoil and that ordeal, actually liberal ideas become dominant. So how do you think, could we expect a revival for liberal ideas or no?
Maybe. I mean, a lot depends on leadership. You know, a lot of the institutions that we think of as the key to, you know, protecting and defending the Western liberal world during the Cold War, like NATO and were the result of particular people pushing for them. You know, in the United States, it was Harry Truman, who was a president who was not, didn't arrive in office with great expectations of glory. You know, he was from a small town. He didn't have any foreign policy experience. Roosevelt didn't even trust him. He was Roosevelt's vice president. Roosevelt didn't even trust him enough to tell him about the atomic bomb. So he was, he came to office really new, but yet he understood the scale of the problem quite quickly and began the work of creating the institutions that were needed to protect it. I mean, the same is true of the European Union, which was, there was nothing inevitable about that. I mean, it was also the creation of a particularly dedicated group of politicians, in Germany, the Netherlands, in particular, France, Belgium, after the war, who pushed for a particular vision and tried to make it happen. And so these things don't happen automatically. There's no rule that says, just because we've had this moment of international solidarity that will translate into something longer lasting. A lot will depend on what, Biden and Macron, if he's reelected, and, Zelensky and, the leaders of other European countries do in the aftermath of the conflict, and whether they see this as a moment when things need to be changed and reshaped, or whether they miss that moment.
So leadership, good leadership is the answer. Okay. Yeah. Another kind of a parallel I'm thinking about is the 1991, when President Bush Senior, he declared solemnly that the US had won the Cold War, but the outcome was far from granted. During the bleak 1970s, the USA and its allies, they seemed to be on the losing side. You remember, yes, the pump crisis, the problems in Italy with budget, so on and so forth. So the liberal order was actually in retreat. And finally, it was successful. So what made the West successful? And is there anything in the recipe to be emulated today?
That's an interesting question. I would have to think about it before giving you a better answer. But you're right that the 1970s were a moment when people really despaired of America, and it was just after the terrible disaster of Vietnam. It was, as you said, it's time of high oil prices, and there was a lot of talk about, American and Western decline. If you look back historically at what happened, none of these is a full explanation. One was, again, this question of leadership. Ronald Reagan was elected president of the United States, and he reinvoked a kind of, it was this strange American combination of sort of American nationalism plus democracy promotion, in which the Americans saw their rule in the world as a, the leading sponsor of and protector of democracy. And that was somehow combined with a belief in national renewal as well. It's a very peculiar, as I said, American phenomenon, which is both internal and external. And it has some ugly sides as well as some good sides. And partly was that he revived that. Also it's a big part of American political culture, both right wing and left wing. There are sort of different versions of it. And he was able to reinvoke that. I think partly was also economic innovation. One of the things that started to happen in the 1980s and then, continuing further, was that the United States and Europe began to outpace the Soviet Union in terms of technology, innovation. It's not just about being richer, although that they were also richer. It was also about, being so far ahead of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union fell behind very dramatically, and its leaders knew that. Funny enough, it was the KGB that really knew it and understood it the best, because they were the people who traveled around the world and they could see. But Gorbachev was very sensitive to the idea that, the Soviet Union was falling behind. And, his idea was that he would revive the Soviet Union through the, through glasnost and perestroika, which, the opposite happened. He didn't revive the Soviet Union. He eventually broke it up because the Soviet system was not able to, once you allowed people to speak the truth, then the faith and belief in the system itself fell apart. But so I think, so it was a combination of these ideas plus technology, plus the failure, the Soviet failure combined, are what made that possible. And I suppose today, therefore, you'd have to talk about some kind of revival inside the United States of our democracy, which is also in trouble. I mean, maybe that's sort of another long story. And that would have to, that revival would have to come together with a renewed dedication to the protection of democracy around the world. I mean, you have almost, it's an interesting moment in the US where you have, for the first time really since anyone can remember, you have the right and the left both supporting the same cause. I mean, Ukraine is actually a popular cause in both political parties. I think it's like the only one. I mean, there's nothing else that I can tell you. We just didn't make it into the written version of our interview, but I think I said to President Zelensky, I was asking him a question about, I said, you realize that your rhetoric has united, the right and left in America. And he sort of looks at me and says, great, thank you. how is that useful to me, so he was happy that we were happy, but some version of that, which could be precipitated by this, by the Ukraine crisis, although not necessarily, plus the gap, the technology gap that really might now begin to grow between Europe and America and the democratic world, which I would also include democracies in Asia and elsewhere, and Russia, which has now been, has become much more cut off in terms of trade and technology from the outside world than I think it was since like the 1970s. I mean, I think even in the 80s, there were more and better, certainly the late 80s and or 90s, there were more and better contacts between Russia and the rest of the world than there are now. And so they've just taken a gigantic step backwards in a lot of ways. And so maybe those combination of things can at least help. I mean, remember, there are many more spheres of this struggle other than Europe, but at least in the kind of European, theater, in the European, in the European conversation, maybe this combination of the Western alliance, which will hopefully soon come to include Ukraine in a more clear way, plus the innovation gains and the way in which Russia is about to fall behind, maybe those things together will create that kind of revival that we saw in the late 80s.
Thank you. I'm actually recalling a very interesting book by Philippe Terre, where he explains that actually the digitalization started in the Anglo-Saxon world precisely when Reagan and Thatcher came to power, and that gave that push for innovation, for outpacing the already declining Soviet Union. So I actually agree with your reading that, yeah, it makes sense. And since Russia is now being cut from the innovation spur, then can hope that that will be that additional component to.
Yeah, and a huge class. I mean, tens of thousands of Russians have just left the country, including a lot of people from the tech industry. I mean, so all the people who are working inside Russia in innovative ways, and Russia is a historically really creative, well-educated country with a great scientific tradition. But a lot of the people who were powering it have just moved to Armenia, or Kiev, or Paris. Maybe not Kiev, but Paris. Tbilisi. They're all in Tbilisi. So the Georgians will be the beneficiaries.
Volodymyr?
Hi, I'm Volodymyr Fedorin. Nice to meet you. Thank you for passing the floor to me. We met 2 months ago. It's happens that we meet when the war is around the corner. And my first question is, what were your expectations then, 2 months ago? We all remember this atmosphere in Munich, in the Munich Security Conference, when there were a lot of talks about imminent or not so imminent war we participated in the poll in during the Ukrainian dinner, when less than about a third of participants voted for the war was imminent. And now we are here. What were your personal expectations then? And what are your expectations now after the 2 months of the most cruel war in 70 years after the Second World War?
So, my feelings about the Munich Security Conference were very mixed. I was very, and I wrote this afterwards, I was very disturbed there by this atmosphere. You know, you had the kind of Western leaders there, Kamala Harris was there, and, Ursula von der Leyen, and, there was a kind of feeling of cheerfulness and consensus that we are all together and we all agree that we all support Ukraine. And then President Zelensky appeared and he made a really quite bitter and angry speech in which he said, "I'm really glad you all support Ukraine, but actually we are alone and nobody's going to help us fight." And you had this deep contrast between, in those two different views. And he was, you probably didn't realize this, but his speech was quite effective. I mean, it wasn't uplifting, but, it affected people a lot. I traveled back from Munich with some American congressmen, and they were all, they got the message, which was that your words of support don't really help us. We need you to actually do something. And so that was my feeling about that conference, was that this contrast in views was exposed. And what was at that time, the kind of emptiness of the Western position was exposed. It became less empty as time went on. I did expect a war to happen, but, I couldn't predict what kind of a war it would be. I can't remember how I voted in that. I've sort of forgotten that we had this, contest. I was very, because pretty much all the Ukrainians I know thought it would not happen. It was hard for me to know what to expect, and they should know better than me. I mean, I was only listening to the Pentagon and to the stuff that the U.S. administration was producing, and many Ukrainians I knew said it was wrong. So I didn't have a firm or clear view of what kind of a war it would be. But now, of course, I understand that the reason so many Ukrainians said that is because they just were unable to believe it. Ukraine and Russia have had a deep and long relationship, and a lot of Ukrainians do watch Russian movies, and they understand Russian pop culture. And the idea that you could get that kind of, as we've already discussed, this kind of genocidal war from a neighbor that, you have many bad experiences with, but some good relationships with individual people. I mean, there are so many cross marriages across the border and so on. I think was just impossible for people to believe. It's also, one person who knows defense and military strategy quite well, who I met in Kiev in December, said to me at the time, he got out this big map and he said, "Look, here's where the Russians are," because by that time they were moving people to the border. And he got out this map and he said, "They're moving people to the border, but they don't have enough troops to occupy Ukraine. They only have, I forget what the number was at that time, 150,000. And he said, to occupy Ukraine, they need 400,000 or 500,000. So I'm just not. And of course, as it turns out, he was right. They didn't have enough troops to occupy Ukraine, but that didn't mean they weren't going to try to invade. So one of the reasons people got the war wrong was because as I said, it defied expectations and beliefs, and B, it didn't look like the Russians had the military strength to do it. And it's true, they didn't, but they were going to try it anyway. And as we now understand, this was because Putin had, extremely poor information about Ukraine. I mean, extremely poor. He understood it very badly. He had no idea who Ukrainians were, or he didn't understand that they would fight. I think he believed this rhetoric about it being a fake country, or just in a NATO invention or something like that. And he overestimated his own troops' ability and massively underestimated the Ukrainians. But so I should say, yes, I expected a war. since that's the precise question you asked, I mean, did I expect exactly this kind of war? I suppose I have to be with my Ukrainian friends and say no. It was hard for me to believe that it would go this far. Not that they wouldn't try and take Kiev, I always believe that, but that they, you know, that there would be this kind of, you know, use of violence against civilians and this, you know, this, for me, it's this behavior of the, you know, the behavior of the Russian army mimicking exactly the behavior of the Red Army in Poland in 1944 and 1945. You know, that there would be this kind of almost exact repeat of the same kind of behavior that we've seen in the past. I think I, you know, that was hard for me to believe because I thought when I wrote about those things that I was writing history books and I was not trying to predict the future. So it's always a shock to see the past come back. That's my, you know, overly complicated answer.
But the second part of my question was, what are your expectations now? After gathering all this information, nobody could think it's possible like Bucha massacres or Irpin or this kind of adventurism. What are your expectations?
So I don't want to predict anything because I don't have a crystal ball, and I am also not.
It's about expectations.
A lot of the war is going to come down to what kind of weapons are available and how people use them, and that's not something I'm an expert in, and so I can't tell you. But my expectation now is that Ukraine will achieve some kind of victory. In other words, I do believe that the West and particularly Washington is now committed to the idea that there will be a sovereign and independent Ukrainian state that will emerge from this conflict. How exactly its sovereignty will be protected, I don't know yet. You know, what exactly is the end game, I don't know yet. But I think that the Ukrainians have so successfully remade your image and remade, you know, the picture that people have of the nation, you know, especially in Washington, but also in London, Paris, Berlin, you know, Rome, and so on, that I think it, you know, it is now seen as a kind of obligation of the Western world, of NATO and the European Union, to make sure that there's a Ukraine that survives the war. So, and more than survives, that, you know, survives as a you know, sovereign, independent, and strong state. But I can't tell you exactly what that will look like right now.
At the same time, what is your definition of Ukrainian victory?
So victory to me, I mean, real victory is, you know, complete victory would be that you expel Russian troops from all of your territory. And then there is some kind of justice. So there's some kind of, I don't know whether it's going to be an international tribunal or some other form of justice so that people who have suffered are able to feel that they have a part in this victory too. And I mean the people in, you know, we know already about Bucha. We don't know yet what's happening in Kherson. I mean, we can guess, and other territories in the east. That would be a complete victory. Whether you can get 100% of that, I don't know right now. I can't predict it.
And the second
but certainly, I think that should be the goal. You know, that should be the goal of the military operation.
And what are prerequisites for this kind of end game for Ukraine? What position the West should take? What perceptions? I mean,
right now, you know, although, as I said, there's some people like Macron and others who are interested in diplomacy and so on, and I don't think they're evil for wanting that. But right now, the main, most important thing the West can do is to make sure that Ukraine wins on the battlefield. Because Russia, as long as Putin is in charge, is going to negotiate from that position. So the farther they get into Ukraine and the more comprehensively they occupy new territory, the more aggressive they will be in the post-war setup. So the best thing that we can do right now to ensure a better endgame and a better future is help you win.
We should and we will. What is your forecast for this kind of political will on the West side?
So I I've spent a lot of the last couple of days trying to understand, since I got back from Kiev, trying to understand how people feel in Washington. My perception is that in the last 10 days or week, that there has been a change. And some of the caution that people seemed to feel 2 or 3 weeks ago is gone. And people are, I mean, the two recent weapons announcements, Biden made one a couple of days ago and another one today, are the first that include these really, you know, again, this is not my area of expertise, but I'm told this is what matters, these big pieces of heavy machinery and artillery, which can help win the war in Donbass. And my feeling is that there's been a change in strategy. So as you know, I think we've had three phases in Washington. The first phase in the run-up to the war and in the first kind of 72 hours was, we think the war will be over in 3 days. We think the Russians will be in Kiev, you know, by whenever it was, the weekend. And, you know, our job is to get Zelensky out of there as fast as possible. That was literally the first in the run-up to the war, and the first 3 days of the war, that was what you would have heard in Washington. There was just very little belief in the ability of the Ukrainian army to fight back. When that didn't happen, there was a shift. And then there was a sort of a month in which the Ukrainians were supplied with these tactical weapons, with javelins and also other stuff and intelligence and other stuff. But mostly it was things that were easy to get and get into Ukraine fast. You know, and you also had other things too. You had the Turkish drones and so on. And that phase was like, oh wow, the Ukrainians are doing much better than we expected. Let's help keep them going. And then my perception is that in the last 10 days, and I don't know exactly why, I don't know whether this is because Zelensky has given a lot of interviews, you know, not just ours, but to other people, whether it's the Ukrainian success on the battlefield, the fact that the Russians withdrew from the north, and you know, there seems to have been a shift again, and now it's like, you know, we have to help them win, and that I feel that this has happened in the last 2 weeks. One of my guesses is that there was a lot of panic here, not panic, but fear, or and fear is the wrong word to be, sort of discussion and anxiety about whether the Russians, if they were trapped, would use nuclear weapons. And there was a great desire here not to seem to be escalating the conflict, because, you know, then, you know, they didn't want it to look like a war between NATO and Russia. I think that when the Russians withdrew, and there was no, you know, it turns out they could withdraw, they could retreat and not set off a nuclear weapon, or, you know, nuke Warsaw or whatever it was that people were afraid of. When that happened, I think people here said, well, wait, you know, they can withdraw, they can change, you know, and then Putin suddenly announced new goals for the war. Now the goal is, you know, whatever he's saying about Donbass. If he can do that with such alacrity, then maybe he isn't going to escalate. And then maybe, so I think there was a combination of things meant that in the last few, literally the last few days, there's been a kind of change. And it's true in all the, you know, all over in most capitals. I mean, you know, I was just in Warsaw also, in Warsaw, in Bratislava, in London, you know, in Paris, you know, there's increasingly a feeling that, you know, we have to do everything that it takes. I mean, the one country where, you know, this is where there's still a huge argument going on is Germany. But it is an argument, you know, there are two sides to it. And publicly, and, you know, Ukraine is more and more popular, and Schulz's government's refusal to engage more is unpopular. So that's already, we're in a different Germany than we were in a month ago.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask you about Germany question or Germany issue, because Tyler Cohn wrote 2 months ago that Germany doesn't like member of the Western Alliance when Germany refused to transmit the weapons to Ukraine through its territory. It was just 2 months ago, and now we have the discussion in Germany about hard munitions, and it's
it's one of these things. It's a glass half empty, or is the glass half full? I mean, so no, Germany is not sending its tanks to Ukraine. Okay, and they haven't decided to do that yet. On the other hand, they aren't blocking anyone else from doing it, and there is a huge public debate about it in Germany. You know, much. So I was actually on a German television program. I can't remember the exact day, but it was before the war. It was probably in, you know, January, late January, earlier February. I was on a German television program, sort of big talk show, where it was me, it was the Ukrainian ambassador to Germany, and three German politicians. And the topic was, should we arm Ukraine? And all three of the German politicians were adamantly against it. And I think they sort of brought me on the program to sort of make this case, you know, even though I'm not German, you know, someone to throw rocks at. I don't know. And you had the feeling the Ukrainian ambassador to Berlin, you had this feeling of he's very great frustration and sort of anger. And I have to say, since then, the debate in Germany has changed a lot. It's very different. And finally, people are understanding that pacifism can also be evil. I mean, in that pacifism, if you don't fight back against, against a genocidal state, then you are assisting that state in achieving its aims. And I think that message finally got through to a lot of Germans. And so that's an achievement, even if we don't yet have the German policies that we would like.
I think that you are one of the best researchers on the so-called Soviet world, about gulags, about prisoners camps, about imperial thrust to the Eastern or Central Europe, like we call it now, about Ukrainian Holodomor. And my question to you is, in your opinion, is a mix of Soviet legacy, communism legacy, and Russian imperial legacy to this push that we see again these days from the Kremlin part, from Putin part?
So it's clearly Soviet, in that we're seeing exactly the same tactics and exactly the same kind of behavior in Ukraine that I'm telling you. I wrote a book on the Sovietization of Eastern Europe. It was a book called Iron Curtain, and it was about what the Red Army and the NKVD did in the, you know, what they did over 10 years, but part of it, the first part of the book is about what they did when they arrived in 1944 and 1945 in first Eastern Poland, which is, you know, and then in, you know, the rest of Central Europe. And, you know, it's like a, you know, it's a textbook example. I mean, frankly, it's what they did in Crimea too. So I saw it in Crimea as well. You know, they arrive with lists of people to arrest. They look for, you know, people who have Ukrainian flags and Ukrainian textbooks in your house. I think you were their house. I think you were referring to that. They look for local police chiefs and mayors and, you know, leaders, and they're looking to decapitate the society and get rid of the leaders, and then to terrorize ordinary people using both violence as well as rape. And that's what they did in exactly, you know, identically what they did. I mean, and of course, those practices probably have an older origin in Russian Imperial Army culture and Russian, you know, secret police culture. So in that sense, they're part of that probably old tradition too. But really, the main influence is Soviet. And the fact is that clearly the Russian army and, you know, the Russian state never went through anything like, I mean, not even close to what the Germans went through in terms of seeking to understand what had gone wrong in the past, seeking to change the institutions to make them more humane. I mean, on the contrary, they literally seem to be using NKVD handbooks. I mean, they're repeating the exact behavior and the exact tactics of the NKVD from the 40s. So it's very hard for me, you know, to identify it as anything else. I mean, for me, the whole thing feels very eerie. I mean, it's like, as I said, it's like seeing your book come alive, you know, it's, you know, and so I look at things like, oh yeah, that's what it was like, you know. Now I understand, you know, what Lublin was like in, you know, 1944, when I see what's happening in Kherson right now. I mean, so it's a very, you know, it's really an exact copy. And I should say that the NKVD, at least, I mean, I've never looked at Red Army archives, but I have looked at NKVD archives. The NKVD did do a lot of learning from its own experience. So they would write up their experience of events, and then they would sort of use that as teaching. You know, they read their own history and they use their own history in order to teach young recruits how to behave. And it looks to me like, you know, they're still using Soviet material to do that, to do the same thing. It looks identical to me.
It worked 70 years ago. Why to change something like this? So let's touch some post-war issues, because I think we all are sure that the war will end with a kind of Ukrainian victory. And my question is about the how will this war change European Union? The union that was built on the feeling that the big war in Europe should ever happen again. What changes in maybe in institutions, in attitudes, will this war produce in Europe?
First of all, I think it will produce Ukrainian membership at the European Union. I mean, it won't happen overnight, because, you know, I lived in Poland during Poland's accession to the EU, and there is a huge amount of stuff you have to do in order to join, other than even if there is goodwill, which at that time there was. But I think Ukraine will now be seen as a European state in a way that it wasn't before. So that will be one big change. And that's a really big change, because Ukraine is a big country. And so therefore, its presence will be felt inside Europe in the way that the presence of Eastern Europe also changed the EU. So that's one kind of change. I mean, I think I'm hesitant to predict this, because I don't see exactly who the leaders are who would do this. But it's pretty clear to me that Europe needs to think of itself not just as an economic power, but also as a security power. And I'm not sure yet how that thinking will manifest itself, whether it will just mean that, you know, Germany spends more on weapons, or whether the reinforcement of NATO, or whether there will be, as there could be, some kind of European army or European, some kind of European security establishment that's different from the one. I mean, NATO, I don't think, is going to go away. I mean, what I'm hoping is that the European part of NATO becomes more developed and stronger. And that, I mean, for example, there are a lot of European countries that don't really have armies and don't really have foreign policies. The Netherlands, I mean, Austria.
So you mean that Europe should rise up its defense expenditures and to become a more meaningful part of NATO?
Yes, it should be a more meaningful part of NATO, and maybe it needs its own, you know, its own way of thinking about security too, because there are some issues that the US, you know, we don't want them to be totally dependent on the US forever. And Europe as a whole, you know, when you add all the countries together, is just as rich as the US, and has the same kind of economic and industrial clout. And so why shouldn't it also have some kind of strategic thinking and some kind of way of, you know, form of self-defense? But we're still pretty far from that. So, you know, it's something some people have been talking about for a long time, but I don't see it happening immediately. But you know, wars do have a way of galvanizing change. So maybe that's one of the things that will come out of this.
I have two more questions. One very important about Ukraine. We all hope that Ukraine will be victorious, we hope that our nation will endure this war of annihilation and we will win, but how to use our victory to become more, even more resilient, even more European nation, not losing chances as our country unfortunately did several times before?
I mean, that's really a question that you would have to answer. You'll be better at answering than me, because you know. I mean,
we'll do. But we need. We are interested in your advice.
I mean, obviously, you know, the power of a small group of rich people who have dubious links to Russia and to international crime and so on has to end. You know, so the this, you know, the oligarchy and the, you know, this particularly, it's not so much the petty corruption. Lots of countries have that, including, you know, France and Germany, but you know, a lot of this making sure that this system of deep corruption doesn't come back, you know, whereby everybody who works for the Ministry of Economics is also separately paid by some oligarch, you know, strengthening the state so that it's a you know, making sure that civil servants are, you know, qualified people who have real salaries, making sure that the state has its is able to be stronger than all of its citizens, you know, and here, you know, again, there are many European countries that don't quite match this ideal either, but pushing Ukraine further in that sense in the direction of modernity, where you have you know, bureaucrats and civil servants, you know, and an army and security services who work for the state and not for private people on the side. Making sure that that's you know, that's the most important thing. So
you recommend us to have gardens like more Poland, like more in Poland.
In which sense, like
no oligarchs, more regular bureaucracy, and so on.
Yeah.
Poland is unfortunately.
Okay, I can hear you.
Okay. Poland is now run by a political party that's unfortunately trying to dismantle some of that and actually create oligarchs. We didn't have that before. And actually undermine the independent bureaucracy and so on. And one of the struggles that's going on in Poland now is to make sure that that doesn't happen. Also, they, you know, the biggest assault they've done is on the independent court system and the judiciary. And pushing back against that is a really important, you know, it's very important that that wins in Poland. But yes, I mean, so if Ukraine were to push in the direction of Poland as it was 6 years ago, yes.
Okay, and the last question, and the situation reminds me about it, air raid alarm in Kyiv. The question is about what should the world do with Russia, the Russian question. What, how do we think the ramp off of this country after Putin, with Putin or after Putin? Because in my opinion, we see that without very, very deep restructuring, this kind of country, this kind of nation, will remain the threat to its neighbors, to the other world. What do you think about this?
Well, we've tried integrating Russia, and that was a failure. Now it looks to me, I'm saying this is what will happen, not necessarily what it should have. Now we're going to try isolating Russia. And I think what's going to happen in the next couple of years is that Russia will be cut off economically and culturally from the rest of the world. And that will be that in fact is what the policy will be. The question of what happens inside Russia and how the country evolves and how Russians react to this isolation and this this kind of feeling of loneliness, whether they
excuse me, Anne, I want to make my question more exact. what we as Ukrainian neighbors in its closest proximity, its neighbors on the planet, what should we demand from this country with Putin, without Putin, it doesn't matter, in order to do things, to do deals with this country again? What are our red lines? What are our demands to normalize?
You should demand that Russia behaves like a civilized part of the world that you want to live in, and you should demand that they respect your borders, and you should demand that they, that people who've committed crimes in your country are brought to justice. I mean, you have a right to continue to demand that, and you should do.
Should we demand some internal reforms? I mean, dismantling this.
You can demand them, but you know, then once again, we're at the question of what influence do we actually have? You know, you don't want to demand things that you can't achieve.
By the actors of demanding, I mean not only Ukraine. I mean the West as a whole. Should West demand from Russia to dismantle successors of NKVD, of this kind of imperial indoctrination, this kind of propaganda?
This is what I wanted in the 1990s. I wrote endlessly.
in order to lift sanctions, in order to trade with the.
Oh, I see what you're asking. Yes, actually. I mean, so I mean, my feeling about Russia more general, more broadly, I didn't quite understand your question, is that our main problem is that we haven't had any kind of strategy towards Russia. So everything that we've done towards Russia, especially in the last 8 years, has been reactive. So they kill somebody in Germany and we react. You know, they murder someone in London and we react. They do this, they violate this rule or that rule, we react. What we haven't had is a clear policy of what we want Russia to be or the way that we hope Russia will develop. And I think what you're asking, and I think it's correct, is that we should use sanctions as part of that leverage. So we want Russia to be a civilized member of Europe. And therefore we need, in order to achieve that, it will have to, you know, not just respect borders and not just, bring to justice people who've committed crimes, but yes, also that it should begin dismantling the security services and particularly the propaganda state that has, you know, brainwashed its citizens. And so, yes, I do think we could make those part of our requirements for lifting sanctions. I mean, with the caveat that, you know, Russia, there's a part of the Russian elite, and this is Putin is, of course, the center of it, which is happy about the sanctions and happy about the isolation. Because it means that, you know, then they can really do whatever they want. So, you know, what we have to hope for is that the majority of the population doesn't accept that.
So, and the audience helps me with the more precise question. If Russia proves to be not, integrate into the rest of the world, if it can't dismantle its security state, should the West or Russian neighbors have a goal to disintegrate this polity, I mean Russian Federation, as a final goal in this secular struggle that we have for hundreds of years?
No, I don't think our goal should be to disintegrate Russia. I mean, it may be that that's what happens, but I don't think that should be our aim, no. I think our aim should be to change the nature of the state, to civilize it.
Thank you very much, Anne. It was a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that you are one of the most important public intellectuals of our time, and I'm looking forward for another discussion. And thank you for all you do for the world and for Ukraine.
Thank you. You're overly flattering. I mean, you know, you in Kiev are the people who are brave, not, you know, the rest of us outside of here. So thank you all for what you're doing. And, you know, good luck to your school and keep it going. And, you know, I'll come next time. I'll be in Kiev for longer and I'll come in real life.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye. Have a good one.
Thanks. Thanks, Mark.